You can support this podcast on patreon.com/firstpawmedia.
Netflix just dropped a documentary about the disastrous Woodstock 99 Music Festival, and it brings up some interesting questions. This is not the first doc about the calamitous festival, as HBO presented theirs last year. Trainwreck, previously known as Clusterfuck, has a distinctive advantage over the HBO doc because the series consisted of 3 episodes structured to mirror the 3 days of the actual festival. If you're a fan of this podcast, well, then you know that we love music festivals. And when Robert saw this one come up in the press a couple months ago under the previous name, we knew we would have to review it here on the show. In this episode, we will lay out the series, give our review, and discuss what we, as a society, music festival goers and fans, can learn from the events of Woodstock 99. Let's kick it off.
Welcome to the Rockin' Coaster Podcast, presented by First Paw Media. Whether your favorite is a Giga, a Steel Dive, or old Woody roller coasters are your thing, or you're a fan of classic rock, hard rock, or grunge, we talk about it here. Each summer, Robert and Michelle Forto travel the country in search of the best roller coasters and music festivals. Sit back and enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to the Rock and Roller Podcast. I'm Michelle.
And I'm Robert.
And here we talk about our love of music, travel, and roller coasters. On today's show, we are going to discuss the Woodstock 99 documentary, Trainwreck, that you can watch on Netflix. And want to warn you right off the bat, there are plenty of spoilers in this episode. And if that matters to you, pause right here, go watch the show, and come back and give us a listen. So I am going to break it down, and Robert will join us later to give his thoughts. The godfather of soul and music festival royalty. So yeah, basically, the opening sequence of episode 1 features real footage of the festival grounds on the Monday morning after the festival. It looks like a war zone. A lot of documentaries and podcasts do this now and give the viewer, listener, a forecasted view of the ending and then work their way backward to arrive at the beginning of the story. Of course, we have all heard the stories of the festival disaster, but this doc starts off with pure carnage. Early in episode 1 and through episode 2, it is structured with some focus by giving the viewer constant countdowns to remind us that, scary as things might seem so far, they can only get worse. If we can set the scene just a bit, most people know about the peace and hippie love fest of the original Woodstock in 1969 and the disastrous attempt in 1994. And quickly in this doc, we meet Michael Lang, who was the man behind the original music festival. And he had lofty goals of bringing in the 30th anniversary show back, well, bigger and better. Right off the bat, we see these things are much different, but I need to remind you that Woodstock 69 was no walk in the park. There were too many people, too many drugs, a heck of a lot of mud, and other problems that occurred in the 94 rendition too. But 99 would be different, right? To start off, they decided on a decommissioned Air Force base that had more than 8 miles of space, huge tarmacs and runways, even a fire station, airplane hangars, and more. But one thing is clear early in this documentary that this festival was designed to be a moneymaker. But aren't they all? Aside from Lang, there were some heavy hitters in the music and festival promotion game that were a part of this festival, and by all rights, they wanted to produce the most epic 3-day event possible, but it quickly got out of hand. One of the first scenes is James Brown refusing to go on stage because he wants to be paid in full before his performance. This set the scene that cost-cutting measures were afoot. We then see Sheryl Crow, The Offspring, and others play throughout the first day, with the closing act, Korn, playing to a massive crowd of more than 250,000 people. You could see the energy that was building, and Jonathan Davis said in his interview, "It's better than any drug when you have that many people in the palm of your hand." The first day and the first episode ended with a scene of the rave after party where 60,000 people packed into an airplane hangar to a naked, drug-fueled musical ecstasy. As the cliffhanger approached, we knew that there were worse things to come in the following 2 days. Break stuff. There is an effort made to understand why things might have gotten out of hand on day one and the Korn performance, but it was the deliberate finger pointing in the direction of Limp Bizkit's Fred Durst by the documentarians that fueled the crowd's rage on Saturday night. One of the journalists equates it to the culture of 1999 that is brimming with sexuality and testosterone-fueled angst by an entire generation of crazed frat boys. But there is more to that story. This festival was just downright poorly planned. It was not 1969. Society and music had changed. Right, Robert?
Yes, you must remember that anytime you watch a doc, you are seeing it through the filmmaker's eyes. Jamie Crawford had a story to tell, and three or four of the acts that fit that narrative were showcased, namely Sheryl Crow and Jewel, because of the salacious attempts at male domination, along with Korn, Limp Bizkit, Bush, Kid Rock, and the Red Hot Chili Peppers, who we will get to later in the show. But there were so many acts playing. We have a full list in our show notes. Namely, there is no mention of Metallica, Ice Cube, Rage Against the Machine, Godsmack, Everlast, and even low-key acts like Alanis Morissette, Creed, Moby, Live, and Muse. You're right, though. Music was at a turning point in 1999, and this festival showcased that.
So let's get back to episode 2. The footage of the concertgoers tearing down the structures remains as powerful today as it was then. It was like watching a zombie movie without CGI. It was real and in your face. Central to episode 2 was the rave after party featuring Fatboy Slim, whose real name is Norman Smith, recalls seeing a van rambling through the crowd and recalls the horrific story of a young girl who was sexually assaulted. And, you know, I'm just going to go ahead and put it out there. She was freaking raped, you guys. Smith recounts in somber reality. He says, "In the midst of all those people having fun and me wanting to make everybody love each other, that was going on under our noses." The issue of the rape is otherwise handled as almost an afterthought towards the end of episode 3. Woodstock original organizer Michael Lang even says that he didn't hear about it or any reports of sexual assault until after the festival was over. "You can't vet the people who buy your tickets. You just can't," he bemoans at one point. Episode 3 is much the same. Nudity, teenage angst, and rebellion up until the Chili Peppers hit the stage, and then all hell broke loose. Through rose-colored glasses of yesteryear, the promoters thought it would be a good idea to pass out 100,000 candles. Remind you that this is way before everyone had a flashlight on their phone. And asked if Anthony Kiedis could calm the crowd down as they hit the stage for their encore. Of course, a happy ending didn't fit the narrative of this doc or actual history, as the Chili Peppers came out and sang Jimi Hendrix's Fire as the crowd literally set the venue on fire. What ensued was almost a half hour of carnage in the documentary as the festival became the gates of hell. the all-out riot, including torching tractor trailers, breaking into the vendor area, including looting and stealing from ATMs, and tearing down the massive art wall fence and the quelling by stormtrooper riot police. The nightmare of Woodstock 99. So the nightmare of Woodstock 99 occurred for a multitude of reasons, from incredibly poor event planning that led to contaminated drinking water on site and 18-year-olds being hired to work security, to what can happen when a young adrenaline-fueled crowd drinks, does drugs, and rocks out hard for 3 days straight. Woodstock 99 descended into a full-scale violent insurrection. The aftermath included 44 arrests, 8 reported instances of sexual assault, including 4 rapes, and overall a dark moment for festival culture as we know it. While the runtime of Trainwreck is longer than HBO's take, the number of artists spoken to is somehow smaller, though Jewel, Gavin Rosdale, and Fatboy Slim are featured prominently, talking openly about the vibes of the experience and why, for example, Jewel left the stage deeply disturbed by playing for a crowd actively calling for a glimpse of her breasts, while some of the voices are similar to the HBO doc. MTV's Ananda Lewis makes a big impression with her talking head segments, delivering some of Trainwreck's most pithy commentary. The victims were easy to mock: millennial influencers. The main villain, Billy McFarland, was arrested for various crimes, and most importantly, no one got seriously injured. Woodstock 99, though, was more than a train wreck for many people who went. It was legitimately traumatic. The verdict: Trainwreck thus has the good taste to save its moments of ecstasy for the festival organizers. When Talking Head interview subjects ask, "How could this have happened?" the filmmakers immediately follow it up with a 1 year earlier flashback, which answers the question.
It is a bleak look at humanity, at least in the eyes of the filmmaker. The doc clearly shows the behind-the-scenes issues that exacerbated the situation, but it also shows the true power and energy of a massive music festival. It is no surprise that some of those who attended that festival in Woodstock of 99 say it was a life-changing moment and it wasn't all negative.
So, Robert, what can we learn from this documentary and music festivals today?
I have been to at least 500 concerts in my life and many music festivals. I've even played in 2 of these huge festivals with my little band Rainmaker right around the same time of Woodstock 99. I played third stage at Somerset Festival in Wisconsin and a birthday bash in Tampa, Florida with many of these same acts as this festival. The point is, aside from burning the place down, pretty much everything you see in this doc was prevalent at any music festival at the time. If you remember, Michelle, the first time we went to Louder Than Life in Louisville, I said, this is not the music festival of yesterday. Here they had gourmet food, bourbon tasting, and fancy exhibits. The thing is, I believe that music festival promoters today, in particular, Danny Wimmer Presents, who in my opinion is the best in the business, have learned from many of the mistakes of Woodstock 99. And music festivals continue to evolve, especially the DWP ones. Think about how Welcome to Rockville has changed. When we went, it was much like the setup of Woodstock 99, as the whole festival was in a parking lot of an NFL stadium. They since moved it to Daytona Speedway, as that being one of the main reasons. Even today, music festivals, especially rock and roll ones, are not for the faint-hearted. They are still overbearingly hot. We have attended Bourbon and Beyond and Louder Than Life when it was more than 100 degrees. There is almost no shade. The festivals are notoriously expensive and very strict on what you can bring in. All of these are examples of changes post-Woodstock 99, and of course, the more recent violence and shootings at several large shows. There is a reason why we pay for VIP passes, At least there, you may find some shade, decently clean porta-potties, and maybe even a place to sit down. My take as to what did we learn, I do believe that some of the story is correct in the film, that it was fueled by angst and greed, but that is only half the story. When you get 250,000 people in any one place at one time, you are bound to have situations like this. There is no way that you can contain the frenzy of that many people with the small attempts at security. It just isn't possible. I think, like I said a moment ago, that the festival experience will continue to get better, especially with the folks like DWP at the helm. As Korn's Jonathan Davis said late in the film, it is the promoter's primary job to keep everyone safe. I think that they have learned their lesson, and just look at how DWP handled this year's Rockville, and you will see what I'm saying. Michelle, what are your thoughts as to what we learned from this documentary and music festivals as a whole?
Well, you know, I was not born when Woodstock 69 came and went, and I wasn't necessarily a concert goer or music festival attendee until I met you in 1999, as a matter of fact. And while I would have most likely enjoyed the prospect and the idea of attending Woodstock 1999, I told you during both documentaries that we've seen about the festival that there's no way in hell I would have stuck around after what we saw transpire on Friday alone. And I understand it was $150, and that was a lot of money in 1999. It's a lot of money today. And I don't think that promoters should take into consideration all of the desires of each and every concert goer. That's impossible. But they should take into consideration safety and the significance of the size of the crowd. One of the videographers on Trainwreck stated it very clearly. It was like the crowd became its own living organism, one being. And that for sure is something that we have witnessed. It's also something that we have felt and that we have been a part of. And it's a lot of the reason why concert goers and festival fans love it so much, because you do become part of one being. And it's a special thing to experience. But when it's 250,000 people, I don't know. That puts a lot of safety concerns into play. And I was taken aback at the way that Lang and the other promoter were just so oblivious to the fact that they should have had some better safety protocols in place. And I'm not just talking about security, you guys. I'm talking about access to water, access to clean areas to use the restroom, and the price gouging that was happening with the food vendors. And of course, everyone's in it to make money. Of course they are, including the little drug dealers that show up and help you have a good time at the party. But it really comes down to, when is enough enough? And if you don't have an opportunity for your concert goers to have a good experience, then you are wrecking it for everyone, including the next person that promotes a show. And I think that that's seriously important.
So to bring it to present day, what did they learn, and how are they implementing it today, aside from what I said?
You know, I think that the restriction on the crowd size has really made an impact. And I think that the understanding that you must hire actual security has also had a large impact, adding in the VIP areas. Now, neither one of these documentaries really focused in on VIP areas, but if you can afford it, you're going to get yourself out of the way of the crowd, especially that crowd that has that mindset that, you know what, we're going and we're going to unleash all of the rage for the crap that we go through. And we're going to use this concert as our outlet, which is great. That's what it's for, especially when you're between the ages of, 15 and 25 and you're a guy. Right. And I don't care what kind of guy you are. Guys between the ages of 15 and 25 are full of angst. They're supposed to be. And rock music is a great way to release all of that. And girls are full of angst, too. And we're full of mischievous behaviors. And we get ourselves into some scary situations from time to time. But, you know, a lot of what I saw has to do with a lot of what we do on some of our other ventures. And that's, you know, there was a lot of groupthink going on. And you could do an entire episode of this on one of our other programs where we teach people all about leadership.
Yeah, for sure. So we're going to do a review here. Obviously, we talked about our thoughts of the documentary and sort of the lead up and how the filmmakers did it, but we're going to do what we call thumbs up, thumbs down, or sideways. Michelle, would you give Trainwreck on Netflix a thumbs up, thumbs down, or sideways, and why?
You know, I'm going to give it a thumbs up, and the reason why is because, I'm going to look at this documentary with a not rose-colored glasses, because we all know that everyone that's telling their documentary is telling it from their own story, right? It's their spin. And because I've watched the other one and because I've seen historical documents about all of the Woodstocks, I totally get it. But what I found amazing about this, you know, even with my thumbs up, what I found amazing and the person I'm going to give a thumbs down to is Michael Lang. He didn't learn from his mistakes. He didn't make it better in 94. And definitely he could have learned from 94's mistakes and made 99 the truly most epic festival ever.
So I'm going to give it a thumb sideways. I will agree with what happened at Woodstock 99 is atrocious. I think the filmmakers told a story that fit their narrative. I will let the viewers decide what they think. And of course, we will still attend music festivals. We're going to Aftershock, which is supposed to be one of the largest rock music festivals in the country, here in just a couple of weeks. Michelle, close us up.
So what do you guys think? Did you watch Trainwreck? What are your thoughts and what can we learn from it? Let us know in the comments or on our socials. Just search Rockin' Coasters. And you guys, I want to add in something else. What do you think our responsibility is as concert goers? Should we be held accountable for some of the ways that we act? Should we be held accountable when a few bad apples, as they say in Trainwreck, wreck it for everyone? Just something to ponder there. And one last thing, did you know the single best thing you can do for our show is tell your family and friends how you listen? Who knows, they just might become a rabid listener just like you. I'm Michelle Forteau for Rockin' Coasters and First Paw Media. See you next time.